Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Mark Porto, and I'm here today on behalf of the appellant, Randy Folkman. As the court is aware from the briefs, there are three assignment of errors from this divorce that we have alleged, and I'll kind of go through them in the same order that are set forth in the brief. First, the first assignment of error relates to an $8,600 accounting that was not included within the marital estate by the district court judge. This was a sum of funds that clearly was withdrawn by Mrs. Folkman during the marriage from a joint account placed into her own individual account. And then within a very short time, within 60 days of that withdrawal of the funds, Ms. Folkman's daughter from a prior relationship closes on a house, and not only is Sherry then placed as the co-signer on the loan to the house, but is also placed on the deed. And it's our position that once we were able to establish that Mrs. Folkman withdrew the $8,600 from the party's joint account, it then becomes the burden on her to sort of identify precisely where those funds went in order to avoid having those funds be recouped back into the marital estate. Now, Ms. Folkman and her daughter allege that it was coincidental, and the withdrawal of the funds had nothing to do with her being placed on the note and on the deed. But I would argue that is strains credibility, given that she is not only just on the mortgage, but also was placed on the deed.
Trial court specifically find the daughter's testimony to be credible?
Yes, that is true, and I understand that we're looking at an abuse of discretion standard. But that being said, there was no specific itemization accounting for where that money went. There was just the testimony that, no, it didn't go to this, it didn't go to this.
Well, did the wife testify it went to a business that she owned?
She said it went to business bills, but what she did not do was identify exactly, sort of the flow of the money going into her own personal account. Don't know why it would have been necessary to go into her personal account, and then sort of the itemization of the bills that were paid to them.
So we don't have documents from her account paying bills or a deposit into her account? Was that offered?
We know the money went from the joint account into the individual account. Okay. And from there, her testimony that was then used to pay bills.
But likewise, you don't have any documentation showing that money was used for the down payment on the home?
That is true. But I would just argue that given the short time frame and the fact that she was placed on the deed, which strikes me as unusual if she was just a co-signer on the note. The second assignment of error relates to medical bills that the court determined were necessaries that were incurred after the filing of the divorce but prior to the entry of the decree. It's approximately $15,000. And here is sort of the opposite argument. Ms. Folkman indicates that there's no dispute that these were for a dental bill and also for bills at the Mayo Clinic. But there's no specific medical records or reports indicating precisely what the procedures were that rendered those necessary, or whether they were in fact truly necessary at the time that they were incurred, or as opposed to something that could have been done at any given time. And given that it was Ms. Folkman's position that these should be considered necessaries, it would have been her burden to present evidence in support of that. And finally, and I think most importantly with respect to this case, is the issue of alimony. I won't go over item by item the factors set forth in 42365, as I'm sure the court is aware of what those are, but I would point out that this was a marriage of relatively short duration, less than 10 years. There were no children born to the marriage. There's no evidence that there was any sacrifice by Sherry in order to help facilitate Randy's career during the course of the marriage. And we know that going into the marriage, at the time of the marriage, Sherry had an income of over $100,000, whereas Randy's income was only $20,000 to $30,000. Given all that, while Sherry does have clearly some medical issues that have, in her estimation, caused her difficulty in maintaining employment and finding employment, the amount and the duration of the alimony that was ordered by the district court, I believe, was an abuse of discretion, given how pretty extraordinary it is. First of all, what you note is that the court utilized the $80,000 a year figure for Mr. Folkman as his income. That was, in Mr. Folkman's estimation, a very high-end estimation of what his income would be going forward. He had started a trucking business relatively shortly prior to the end of the marriage, and for 2013, his income was $80,000. But for 2012, it was only $65,000. And so the judge's choice to use $80,000 was clearly at the extreme end of what the evidence dictated his income would be, and was an outlier in Mr. Folkman's estimation. The evidence also indicated that Sherry was making $1,800 a month through income earned by somebody she was caring for, as well as in-kind benefits from that person as well. If you take the $65,000 figure and divide that by 12, it comes to a gross monthly income of $5,400 for Mr. Folkman, $1,800 for Sherry. And then if you subtract the $2,000 that the judge ordered from Mr. Folkman's gross income, add that into Sherry's, you come to Sherry with a total gross monthly income of $3,800 and Randy at $3,400. And I would just submit that level of alimony, given the fact that this was a relatively short duration marriage, no children, no sacrifice by Sherry to help facilitate Randy's career, and given the amount, 48 months, I believe this was simply too much. There's also no evidence that Sherry had made any effort to look for any other employment. She was simply content caring for the person that she was, and that's fine, but I do think that at some point it becomes punitive and unfair to hold Mr. Folkman to this level of alimony for this amount of time, given the absence of most of the factors set forth in the alimony statute.
Was there any evidence to rebut her evidence that she was not able to earn any more because of her declining health?
No, but I would submit that's something that is very difficult for Mr. Folkman to have produced evidence of. But I would submit no, there was not any evidence saying, no, she can do this, she has the ability to work. But I think it's a little bit difficult to imagine that her income would be reduced this much, given that she was making at the time of the marriage, just less than 10 years prior to the conclusion of this marriage, over $100,000.
So are you saying there should not have been any alimony given at all, or that the amount should have either been reduced or for a shorter period of time, or both?
I think all of the above. It was our position at trial that there should not have been alimony. I don't believe this is an alimony case, but in the event that alimony is appropriate, and I can't sit here and say that the judge abused her discretion by ordering some alimony. I think that makes that would not be a fair representation. I think I can't say that was an abuse of discretion. But the amount and the time frame that she ordered, I do believe constitutes an abuse of discretion, given that we don't have very many of the factors met, if any, that are set forth in the alimony statute.
Did you make any suggestion to the trial court as to what would be an appropriate amount or for what period of time?
I do not believe so.
Do you have anything you want to tell us?
Well, I think somewhere between $500 and $1,000 a month would make sense. Again, I'm not going to say that no alimony should have been awarded, but $2,000 is a truly extraordinary amount given Mr. Folkman's income. And I believe $500 to $1,000 is consistent with helping Ms. Folkman make ends meet, especially after the deviation of the bills and expenditures that were ordered in, by the district court.
And for $1,000 for 48 months, you think is appropriate?
I would submit that that, it'd be hard for me to say that that would be an abuse of discretion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Council Frappoli, good afternoon.
May it please the court, counsel. Scott Grafton, I represent Sherry Folkman, who is the appellee in this matter. And in reviewing the assignments of error, as it pertains to the first assignment of error, the $8,600 that was taken from the joint account and put into my client's account approximately 13 months prior to the complaint being filed in this case, it would be tough for us to know where do you draw the line on something like that? Could he have gone back 5 years and said, where'd this $500 go? We can't be prepared to rebut everything that's happened for the 10 years leading up to the complaint in this case. The uncontroverted evidence at trial was that it was used for business expenses. If they believe that it went to a lender or to a seller of real estate, they certainly could have sent a 34A subpoena to the lender. They could have sent a 34A subpoena to the seller. They could have done a 34A subpoena to her bank to see where these funds went. They did none of those things. They say it's mighty suspicious that her name showed up on her daughter's deed, who is unmarried and has a minor child, and therefore you should ding her with the $8,600. That could have been done for any number of reasons. Perhaps if something happened to her daughter, she wanted the house to pass to her mother so that it wouldn't go to someone else. There's any number of reasons. But there's no shifting burden here. If they had some evidence that this $8,600 was used for anything other than what my client testified it was used for and her daughter testified it was used for, they didn't present that evidence. And it's not our burden. Again, how far do you go back? Well, in 2005, she took out $500. Tell us where that went. How are we supposed to know, though, that, to rebut that? The records were available. They could have obtained the records. They didn't. And certainly, if they would have, we would have been aware that was going to be an issue, and we would have rebutted that issue. As it is, the record before the court is pretty clear. It's uncontroverted. Those went to marital business expenses. As pertains to the medical bills, I guess our argument would be this is not a damages case. This is a marital debts case. I think it would be wholly unreasonable to require us to subpoena a doctor from the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, to come in and testify that these bills are reasonable and necessary. I understand that's the burden in the damages case. This is a marital debts case. It was a debt that was incurred.
Wasn't it after separation?
It was after separations, but for conditions that were existing at the time during the marriage. It would be akin to if my wife gets cancer, I run out and file for divorce and say, deal with it. We're separated. I think that's wholly unfair, and I think that is the position that the trial court took in this case. If it would have been for cosmetic surgery, a tummy tuck, whatever, I don't think the judge would have ruled as she did. But these were longstanding conditions. Mr. Folkman was aware of them. These were appointments and treatment that she had received during the marriage. And it just so happened he runs out and files for divorce and dumps it on my client. And the most important thing is my client couldn't get need-based assistance due to her limited income because she was still married to Mr. Folkman, and it disqualified her because they had to use his $81,000 income to determine whether or not she qualified. So that's the tricky part in this case. If they had health insurance, it wouldn't have been an issue. If they wouldn't have been including, if she wasn't married to Mr. Folkman, she could have gotten needs-based assistance. And that's why I think the court determined and ruled how it did. Again, this wasn't a change of circumstances after separation. These weren't new conditions. These weren't anything out of the ordinary. Mr. Folkman testified he was aware of the conditions and that she had treated for these conditions during the marriage.
But they were for debts that were incurred after the separation.
Correct.
Okay.
And I believe this, there's no hard and fast rule as to when to value the marital estate. The court, as long as it bears a rational relationship to the marriage, we think that this did. The trial court determined that it did. And again, it's not a damages case. We shouldn't have to bring in a doctor and ask him the magic language to reasonable degree of medical certainty. Were these related to whatever? It's just I don't see that very often in divorce cases where you bring in a doctor to establish medical bills. I see it a lot in personal injury and work comp. This isn't that type of a case. So I think it differentiates itself, and I think that with the evidence that was before the trial judge, where both parties acknowledged these were pre-existing conditions during the marriage, I think that you have to continue on, especially when she's getting disqualified from getting needs-based assistance because of the marriage.
Was the argument at trial that the charges weren't reasonable and necessary, or was it they weren't marital debts?
They weren't reasonable and necessary. There was no testimony from a doctor saying that they were necessary.
That was the defense at trial.
That was the defense at trial.
What date was used for valuing the estate, marital estate?
The valuation of the marital estate, I believe, was the date of filing, and these, certainly, these medical bills were different than that. This was an ongoing issue. It's kind of like a farm or anything else where you have a moving target. Sometimes you have to value certain assets and certain debts at different times to reach an equitable result, and that's what the court did in this particular case. As it pertains to the alimony issue, counsel, during his portion of the argument, had the court presuppose things that weren't supported by the evidence. Number one, indicated her income was $1,800 when in fact it's $800 as indicated in the record.
$800 a week or a month?
A month. Because she gets $1,800, but $1,000 of that goes to cover expenses for the in-home health care that she's providing. So she has to provide food, she has to provide transportation, she has to provide those types of things for the elderly gentleman that she was taking care of. And after she paid all of those expenses, there was $800 left for her to use as her income. So if we take 8 times 12, 800 times 12, we're at $9,600 per annum for her. The trial court, and I think rightfully so, used Mr. Folkman's most recent income, which was $81,000. Again, counsel during oral argument wants you to use $65,000, which wasn't reflective of his income closest to the trial. So by my count, my client went from making $130,000 at the time of the marriage to $9,600 at the time of the divorce. Mr. Folkman went from making $20,000 or $30,000 at the time of the marriage to $81,000. So my client went down $120,000, and he went up $50,000 during the marriage. And this isn't a spousal support case. They didn't want to pay any spousal support. And when you take the $9,600 and add $24,000 to it, then you're at the $33,000 range for my client, while he's at the $61,000 range. But I think those two numbers, he's still nearly double the income even after he's paid spousal support, based on the most recent income figures of the parties leading up to the trial in this particular case.
Did the evidence show that while taking care of this elderly gentleman, that your client received housing or meals or anything of that type?
She provided the housing. She provided all of those types of things. And then essentially what happened, my understanding of the arrangement was this gentleman lived with her in her house. She had to make the house payment. She had to pay the insurance. She had to pay the taxes. She had to pay the meals. She had to pay all of those types of things. And they gave her a lump sum to cover all of those expenses, which her testimony was equaled approximately $1,000 per month out of $1,800 she got from this gentleman's family. So her net to herself was $800 per month.
But that would be after deducting her housing and her food.
Deducting food that she provided to the elderly gentleman, deducting room and board that she provided to the elderly gentleman.
Well, but it's provided for her, too. I mean, their housing.
Half, yeah.
Well, I mean,
theoretically. For tax purposes, those are the deductions she's allowed under the tax code. And that was her testimony at trial. On the cross appeal, it's a little bit of a convoluted issue. I don't know that I can articulate it for the court, but it seems to me that my client owned a camper free and clear. The parties wanted to buy a house together. So the parties took a loan for the down payment, the amount of $11,611.28. I guess my client's premarital camper that she owned free and clear. And then Mr. Folkman, he inherits some money. But the loan against the camper went to the benefit of both parties to reduce the principal that was owed on the house. So Mr. receive a $17,417.42 credit for $11,611.28. I think since he uses inherited funds to pay down his own debt, he should have received a credit of $5,806.14, which is one half of the $11,611.28 that the court gave him. With that, I would submit it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And appellant's counsel is out of time. All right. Thank you both, counsel. You're excused. The matter is submitted. The next matter is In Re Interest of Maya T. In Re Interest of Maya T. Good afternoon.